Hello, and welcome to another episode of Can I Have It in Blue, a podcast about design, technology, product, and everything in between. I am Álvaro Bezerra, a product manager at Subvisual, and together with me I've got João Ferreira, CPO at Subvisual, and Mar, product designer at Subvisual as well. And today we're going to talk a little bit about the gaming industry and how it is to work there. And so, Mar, I know you have a lot of experience on it. How did you reach that industry and what got you there?
Yeah, so basically it was a bit of a roller coaster until I came into the gaming industry and even product design and UX in general. I have a background in fine arts. I went to a high school specialized in arts where I defined my path there to set design and fashion for theater, which has really nothing to do with this. And then once again, I decided to go in another path during university, and I went to Southampton in England, and I went there to study film production. Unfortunately, COVID hit, so midway through my first year. So I came back to Portugal, and I finished my first year, and they gave us an option to drop out without losing the year. So we got kind of a certificate. It's a higher nationals. And after that, I started doing more freelance work as an illustrator, where I did some illustrations based on games, especially more of concept art for a bit more of retro and indie games, which was very cool. It was a very cool experience. It was for school projects, university projects. But after that, I did a lot of stuff. I worked as an executive assistant, personal assistant, and midway in 2022, I started working in the HR world, and it was really not creative enough for me at all. But I understood that I liked dealing with people a lot, and I really enjoyed understanding people behavior, human behavior. So in the beginning of 2023, I quit my job and I went to do a bootcamp in UX at Iron Hack, and after that, I landed my first job as a UX designer at a gaming company. And yeah, that's more or less how I ended up in that world.
I'm curious as well, how did that world came into your, in your perspectives of career? Like, how did it, obviously, was it just a career shift for, like, it felt safer to go that route? Was there anything there that in product design or UX world, let's say, that called you, that made you feel like that was the way to go?
Yeah, so as I said, I really enjoyed working with people and human behavior. And my boyfriend is a UX designer as well, and he was already working as a UX designer at the time. And he was the one who kind of planted the seed on the subject, because I quit my job and he was like, well, like, don't you like what I do? What if you go and do a boot camp and try it out, see if you like it? And I kind of took the challenge and did it and completely fell in love with it during the time of the boot camp. And I really understood that it was something that I really wanted to do, because I am a big problem solver. That's why, for example, I liked being a personal assistant, because you have a lot of personal problems of the people that you're working for to solve. And I guess that's the part of UX that I enjoyed more and that pushed me more. And the gaming part, it was more that I am an older sister and we are six, but I was the only girl for a long time. So I grew up with boys, and it was basically either I would play with them or I would play alone. And most of the times we were either playing football or playing games. And I guess that's where it started to be a very active part of my life, games.
Yeah, but even before the actual gaming industry, I would say the shift to UX with the bootcamp and coming from a very creative background and rich, and very, very different. But how was it like, what would you say were the main adaptations or learnings that you had to take in order to, you know, jump into the UX side of things, which is obviously sometimes viewed as less creative and more analytical, let's say? What were the main, you know, adaptations or learnings that you took on that bootcamp or even that first experience into the UX field?
I mean, it really is different. It's a very different path, especially because I mostly paint. I would say that's my creative part. And my type of painting is caused to a condition that I have, which is called synesthesia, which I associate emotions and people with colors. And the way I can put it is like, if you close your eyes and you see little lights, sometimes that's more or less what I see when I feel a strong emotion, but with different colors. And I paint that, so it's very abstract. So it was kind of hard to change my creativity to something so clinical, let's per se in these terms. It was very fun understanding what was my type of design and really understanding that I had my own image in terms of design and in terms of what I designed in apps. I normally use a lot of color, and because of synesthesia, I have a very strong connection with color theory and color in general. So I always try to focus my designs a lot around it and try to use color and typography the best way I can. But I would say that that was the biggest part, was learning how to change something that's so abstract, at least in my view, to something that's more palpable. Because in the beginning of the bootcamp, I would look around at people and they were like being so fast with their sketches. And I was just like, I thought about the brief for the app, like the exercise, and I could only think of colors and blobs of like different patterns, and it was being really hard for me. But then I started to dive more into the part of human behavior and the user behind it, and that's where it really became the connection, the part where, okay, I can build this in a very easy and grayscale way, and then I can put the colors and my view of what I feel about it. So yeah, I think that was more or less the process between those two things.
And regarding being into or stepping into the gaming industry as like a first, you know, professional take into the UX side, feels a bit like an unnatural thing, right?
Yeah.
I assume that gaming industry is very, well, actually it depends, but I assume it's very heavily focused on UX, right? It's the look and feel and making sure that, you know, the user is fully aware of everything they need to do on the game, whatever it is. The assumption on gaming industry in general, not in the game, the actual game we worked with, it feels like a very unnatural, like, first approach into the UX world.
Yes.
But and particularly now adding that layer of Roblox, which is probably for those who are listening to us who are familiar with that game, it's like we wouldn't necessarily associate UX with that game.
At all, yeah.
Tell us a bit about how that went for you in the beginning and, well, the whole thing in general.
Yeah, it was very unnatural, I would say, because I got off the bootcamp with everything in my mind very fresh, like all of the steps that you need to go to like build an app. It's like, you know, when you just learned how to drive and it's like you do everything by like the code and everything. And it kind of going into the gaming industry kind of made me understand that, okay, maybe I can turn here instead of doing this the way that I was taught. And it was very different. And it was weird because it was very different, but it was the same at a time because the context and the steps were the same. They were just done differently. And with Roblox, it was kind of hard because Roblox is, for people who doesn't know, it's a sandbox platform where you have a lot of games, which the platform itself, Roblox, has the engine to make the games, which is Roblox Studio, which has a feature of drag and drop. So even 5-year-old kids can do games in that engine. And the sandbox, the game itself, Roblox, it's filled with games made by children. So like if you go on YouTube to learn how to use the engine, the probability of having like an 11-year-old explaining you how to code in that engine, it's like 90%, I would say, which was pretty funny to me. But in terms of design, it was just hard because most of the audience, which is kids, they don't normally have a computer, so they play on their phones. And it's very hard because the surface, like more or less half of the screen is filled with control panels. So you really have to go around it with the UI and still make it enjoyable for the kid and make him understand what he needs to do at the same time. But it's just hard because most of those kids, either they don't read or they just don't want to read. They just skip past stuff. And it's very hard to keep their attention in one game. I think that was the biggest challenge, is how do we captivate these kids to spend more than 5 minutes in this game? Because, I mean, I guess that has to do with their generation as well. Because those kids are living in a generation of fast consumption and fast rewarding, like from platforms like TikTok and like Instagram stories and whatnot, which is very short videos that you get a reward sensation at the end because you just finished. So most of these kids don't want to play a story-based game, very heavy game, like at all. I would say they wouldn't even maybe play the career path on FIFA at an extreme point. But yeah, it was hard, but it was interesting because I had to kind of scratch a lot of the UI part and try to understand, okay, how can I induce these kids to do something and go to a certain point without breaking the whole game or put a text here, or even if it's a notification, because they just wouldn't read it. So I would say that was the biggest challenge. And also there were a lot of challenges between inside of the platform itself and the company, but that's another story. But yeah, I would say that it was very interesting in the UX part, but I was able to experience UX itself more in when I was playing in the production of a Steam game other than on Roblox, I would say.
You mentioned like two or three things that will take me to other different questions. But I will start with one, which was like this idea that Roblox Studio can be used by kids was something that I also found out myself, like dealing with kids. It was like, oh, I made a game. I made a game on Roblox. And obviously it wasn't like a game, you know, a full game or anything even remotely similar. But there was things you could do. You would gain, you know, points or coins or whatever it is that they do there. So there's a side of that that's really powerful, right? Which is, how can a kid make a game? So the sandbox must be at least somewhat powerful enough and simple enough that even a kid can do it, like an 8-9-year-old kid can use it. That's an interesting thing that they have there, right? Because it's a very, very common thing. As you mentioned, like 90% of the YouTubers talking about it are teaching how to do it are kids. And it's true, and that's powerful in itself, right? There's something there that's very exciting. I don't know, at least for me, it was like, wow, this must be great at some level to be this accessible.
Yeah, it is. It is, really is. Like, it is accessible with like the drag and drop option, and then like kids that are more tech savvy, I would say, go into like easier coding and whatnot and understand. And there's a lot of codes and cheat codes where you can go around the engine without really coding, but having coding performance in the game. Like, for example, like a lot of them know how to code HTML and CSS enough to like put in a song while their game is playing, for example. And I think that's great for like a 10-year-old. Like, I remember that I only knew how to do that because of Tumblr and editing the things that I wanted to have there. And I think that's very good. It's just hard, I think, for people that are in the industry, in terms of when we're professionals, we are used to having more difficult tools to design and to make the games. Like, for example, like normal games are made on like Unreal Engine and whatnot. And I think we make it harder than it really is, because like I remember the coders being like, no, but it can't be this easy. Like, it can't just be like this button in the line of code. And because like in Unreal, it's like a full two pages. And it really was, because they have scripts already embedded and all of those things. It was just a bit hard in terms of UI, because on the contrary of codes, they don't make it easy at all for you to make UI in-game, because in the engine, you have to work it more or less how you work with Photoshop. So imagine using Figma, but Photoshop version. So it's way harder, and you have to work with a lot of X and Y and assets, and it's just hard. And I had a bit of a learning curve with that. So I was more focused in the company as UX more than UI. That's why then after some games on Roblox, they put me as the UX for the Steam game that I think they're still producing. And that was more, I would say it was more interesting to me as a product designer as well, because it was, I felt more connected with the project because it was a type of kind of horror game-ish type of thing, but very cartoony at the same way. I would say if you think of like Little Nightmares type of vibes. And it was very interesting because it was a game that I would play if it came out. So yeah, and it was very interesting doing the playtesting for that game, which product design and UX translates to user interviews. And it was very interesting learning how to do those user interviews without asking questions a lot of the time while they were playing, because, I mean, you want the player to do the things on their own. So yeah.
That's really interesting. I'm curious, well, as a product manager, how does all this knowledge, either by watching people play or even looking at the sandbox and the custom pieces of code that the kids add to it, how does that inform a roadmap or a prioritization of features to be implemented in the product? I'm sure if you have visibility on that, but I'm curious.
My company had a bit of a hard time dividing roles. So I was sometimes PM with a PM on the project and everything. And I was trying to do UX and I looked at myself doing an Excel of prioritizing tasks because they didn't know how to use Jira, for example. And it was kind of hard. But I would say it influences in terms of when the producer, normally it would start in pre-prod for the game, which would be the producer, the PM, and if it is a client-based game, so if we have someone from outside paying us to do a game, for example, imagine a brand, that person would be included too through the PM, not directly with someone else, but and then normally it's someone from code. And I was trying to be the ambassador to someone letting us have UX in the pre-prod, which I was able to in one of my projects. It was interesting because that project was definitely the one that had best performance in terms of playability and player retention. So I think it influences a lot because having the UX can understand what do kids know as patterns in the app and whatnot. And the UX can then tell the producer and the PM around budget and whatnot. Things, for example, I had no information about budgeting and how much things cost, for example. So I would normally say we need to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things to the producer. And then the producer would meet with the PM and they would, okay, how many of these things are a priority within our budget? And then they would rush us all because there was no budget for anything. But yes, I guess that's life in almost everywhere. So yeah.
Yeah. And how would then the PM, besides budget, because from my understanding on Roblox, it's an ongoing game. So how do you, as a development team or as a product team, how would you decide what comes after? Or is it, it's done, the sandbox is done, the game is done, and now people just play around with it? Or is it there more development?
No, there's more development. So basically, you, on the pre-prod, the PM and the producer decide everything that they want to have in-game that as a budget overall for like the year that they have for the game, they would be able to fit in terms of construction of the game. And then if there's a bit of budget left, they do updates, like, for example, a Christmas update or a Valentine's update or, I don't know, LGBT Pride update. But normally what happens is that you have the MVP, so the base game that you, what you need to launch it. You launch that once you have it, and then you have like 2 more updates on the road, like 1 month after the other, where you add the rest of the features. So you can already put it in use and first start making revenue from the game, and also to understand how players are engaging it. Because if the users are not engaging with the game, then the biggest probability, if it's not a branded game, is that they're going to kill the project. Because it is so easy to make games there sometimes if they're not branded. Because if their internal experience is normally, it's less effort, it's easier, it's normally a coder and a designer that had like a project together on their free time and decided to pitch it to the company and whatnot. And if it just doesn't work, they just kind of kill the project. At least in the company I was, it happened like that. I cannot say about the other ones, but in that one, it was more or less like that.
You touched on that topic of, you know, let's say analytics, conversion rates, analysis of stats, whichever they are. I guess you talked about, you know, the ability to keep them in the game for, you said, 5 minutes or something like that. I was wondering what other, and you mentioned briefly, but I was just wondering, like, if you had any visibility of the key metrics that the business, I guess, side of things used as the key metric, as the North Star, let's say, of the project. And taking the opportunity just to mention another thing, like for some, like we probably assume, you know, gaming industry, very creative processes should be around that, like you're making up games and stuff, but it doesn't feel like there was a very creative environment for it. It felt a bit more like, again, like a data-driven effort and not so much as a creative effort. Might be because of the game itself or the sandbox itself.
Yeah, I believe it's because of the sandbox of Roblox itself, because I did not have that feeling while I was working on the Steam game. Because it's the way you're creative in games with your design is very different, because when you want to be creative in an app, you just do out-of-the-box design or something. On games, normally, you have to be creative around having the less or the most minimal UI that you can, because, I mean, no one wants to be playing a game and have their screen like clustered with icons and buttons and everything. For example, like me now that I'm playing Baldur's Gate, like I prefer playing it with a controller because I don't like having all of the UI like on the PC, like in front of me. It just confuses me. It's just a lot of icons and stuff. So, and that's normally what a user when playing goes for. And it was very interesting because the way in the Steam game that I was allowed to be more creative was around the senses of the user, since it was more of a horror game. The question that I had to make myself was, how can I make this game scary without, first, jump scares, because they're kind of tacky, and second, how can I induce fear and the feeling of being watched and stuff? And that was, I had to work a lot with sound and work a lot with the sound team and understand what was possible and whatnot, even giving voice to the character, which the character did not have at the time, and just having inputs between the character and you. Breaking the fourth wall makes you more inside of the game. So that was, for example, one of the things that you have ways to be creative. On Roblox is a bit harder, I would say, because the way they retain users is not by making them immersed in game. They retain users by giving them rewards. And those rewards can be the currency in game, which is Robux, or it can be giving them
unique items, skins. Yeah,
those type of things. And normally, I mean, kids like to collect things. I remember when I was a kid, I collected rocks that I found on the street. So, you know, it's very consumer-based sometimes, but that's a whole another topic there.
But those items, those rewards that you mentioned, were they, like, always there? I'm asking this because that I had never dealt with that. So they, when I was with them, they would show me the game and then make me play the game. And they never really mentioned anything about those rewards. So what you mentioned before, like they'd skip into other games, was very true. Like they couldn't stay in a game for longer than 2-3 minutes. We played like 2-3 minutes. And then one of the kids was already playing another game. And at some point, this conversation started happening where they were saying, oh, we need, if you go this year, blah, 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 they will get this amazing item. And at some point they spent like 1 hour just looking at items that they could win, like rewards they could win by doing X, Y, and Z on this game or that game, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know if that was always there, but I remember very clearly when I heard about it, was because for them was like a big thing. I don't know if it has a holding powers, if it's something that will keep them going, like to check those columns, right, to get those rewards. Yeah. But I remember the impact it had when they learned about it. So I don't know if it was already there, if it was something that was new, but had an impact.
I think it was always there, but it has definitely grown in the past, like I would say 3-4 years, which is with this generation of kids who are now like between 8 and 12, they are very focused on that. And rewards, it's more or less the only way possible that you can get kids to do quests on these games and actually engage with your game. Because, for example, imagine if you have a skating game, like the fun part of the game is the quests that you have to go and to the half pipe and do XYZ. I don't know any skate maneuvers, but and that's what's fun, I would say. At least for me, playing, like, I'm more of a side quest player than even a main quest one. But these kids, they're just not. And it's just hard to put in our heads sometimes because they really just don't care. So if they go into this skating game and they can just, they think they can just go around in their skate, they get bored in like a minute and they just go, okay, I'm just going to look for something else that's more fun. Because I believe Roblox was better a few years ago from what I know, but now it's just very consumer based and stealing attention with rewards, not really the core of the game itself. That's why most of the companies don't spend money at the actual core and mechanics of the game, because kids will not care about learning how to play a game because they won't be there enough time to do so.
Yeah, in my experience, like, there were some games that had some staying power, but what in this case, what I mean by staying power is not that they played it for that long, is that they kept coming back to it, but they would always jump to other games very quickly. You know what I mean? Like, there were some games that every night when I played with them, we would play that game for a little bit. Then we moved to other new ones, but that game was always there, you know? I've never seen them play a game longer than 5 minutes. I don't think so. But I know that there are games that I always play with them, that they regularly go back.
Yeah, normally it's the typical games that just normal society likes. Like, I mean, my generation is FIFA, car games like Need for Speed, I would say. Those are the more mainstream games, I would say. Yeah, I think for them, it's more or less on the same vibe. It's like sports-based games, like FIFA games there, because you have those. FIFA has experiences there, some like NHL hockey games. Then you have some platform games never die. They just go around and around, especially because it's easier, because it's always a new level. So you can kind of more or less induce them that the level hasn't ended. So they keep on going and they kind of lose track of time until they feel bored of just jumping and going around. But yeah, one thing that I learned a lot is that you have a lot of retention in games if you just have a spamming key. If you give the kids in that game a mechanic where they can just spam a key, even if it's space, whatever it is, it's crazy. Like, it increases the retention time. I think it was like 35 or 40%. It was something crazy just by adding like a spamming action. I don't know if that's a generational thing. I mean, I do that as well while playing.
The jump key? But you're always jumping.
Yes, I'm skipping everything.
Yeah, just jump.
And then I'm like, oh no, I shouldn't have skipped that.
They definitely have grinding games there, for sure.
And
maybe it's the spamming a key. Maybe it's like, we're doing this so that we can do that, so that we can do that faster. Or you can do this at a normal rink, but if you spam the button, it's faster. So I absolutely noticed that trend that you just mentioned of like spamming keys for some reason or grinding at something. You know, there are a lot of games there, or at least I played a bunch of them, where grinding was literally the game. It was like, you do this to do that, 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 to hopefully get to that. And you're literally just doing very well, for me, obviously, very boring, mindless tasks. But you are always evolving. And so that gave them a sense of comparison and like, maybe if I just need to do this to get bigger or to get better or blah, blah, blah. And it worked for them for some reason. But definitely when you said the spamming key, I just noticed my like a Vietnam memory. I go back to it, which is like those kind of games where like, you need to do this to get it faster or to get bigger or blah, blah, blah. I also get what you're saying about the more traditional games being represented there, like even first-person shooters and stuff like that. They seem to work well because they are simple enough to understand, I guess, right? You jump into it and you already know what's expected of you.
Yeah, you have some of those games, which is something that was growing a lot on the platform at the time that I quit the company, that job. It was horror games were coming a lot into, and the kids are a lot into memes. And they have the weirdest memes, which like a trending game that was on Roblox that had like millions of players every day was a game called Skibidi Toilet, which was like a scary game where you like have to flush a toilet and then you have like a demon that jump scares you out of the toilet, out of the sun. And then you have like a first person shooter and at the same time you have platform game induced. It was just the most chaotic game that I've ever seen. And I believe, I might be wrong, but I believe it was made by a 11, 12 year old, something like that. And it was just crazy, especially because technically above a certain play rate you are paid. But that was a whole nother thing, because then they kind of take advantage of kids on that way, then make the games, because since the kids don't know that, they are not being paid unless they request for it. And I mean, an 11-year-old is never going to make a game to be paid, or the normal average 11-year-old, I would say. So yeah, there's a lot of things in the platform that I would say are more or less predatory in those senses, which then influences not having good UX in the platform, because they don't want you to have good UX, because if you have good UX, then the kids are not going to do what they want them to do. So yeah, and I believe that's why I was getting kind of tired of being there. I was not tired of the gaming industry in general, but I was tired of working as a base main part of my job, working in Roblox.
It's a very interesting topic you mentioned. One that, by the way, for those listening, we are planning on talking about in the future, not in this episode, but talking about these elements that you just mentioned and some, you know, shady behavior or intended poor UX for better conversion. I'm doing air quotes, you can see it. That's one for another episode, but one that actually we will have a lot to talk about as well. Great. I don't know, Alvar, if you have anything else other than that. I think this was really cool, but I don't know if you have any questions to add.
I have one going really back on when we started, which is you mentioned behavior and your interest in human behavior. And of course, we talk a lot about it. But right now, I was just questioning the incoherence of the effort that is put into finding rewards and collectibles for doing X, Y, Z, while the main rewards, or well, the reward with more real value, which was getting money for the games, hidden or well deprioritized. Well, in essence, how is this, well, this behavior, this searching for collectibles, but at the same time ignoring a very real reward, is it manifested somehow on the users, or they just ignore it because they are kids?
I think some of them ignore it because they just have sometimes no attention span. I mean, that's something that's clinically proven already, is that the younger generations are being born with a lot of ADHD patterns and whatnot. So they just don't have the attention span for it. And sometimes it is very hidden, because what brings us money from the game is not them sometimes playing the game, but the rewards, especially if it's a branded experience, because they would pay us for the amount of items so that we would allocate. So, for example, if they wanted like a Friday special, they would pay us to put like 15,000, imagine, items to be rescued there. And if we get all of those 15,000 rescued at the end of Friday, then the next time the brand asks us for it, we can say, oh, but those already, they expired so fast. Why don't we, instead of 15, we put 30,000, so you pay us double the money, you know? So sometimes I believe they induce the kids to go after rewards, because that's really what made the company stay above water, I would say. It was not internal projects at all. But as I say this, I believe it's with any company that works in Roblox, not just this one, because I believe this is just Roblox culture. Because it is the way that the users are basically, it's the way that they learned how to play the engine and the game. So, like, the sandbox platform itself. So if they already learn it that way, you're going to captivate always more users if you go with the current, even if it's wrong, than if you go against it, you know, even if you're doing like a good UX job or an actual good game. It's probably that's going to, as they say a lot, they comment in a lot of games that didn't have rewards, like, it's a flop. It's a flop. And it's amazing, like, the dialect that you learn from kids while working there and doing the user tests, but yeah.
Really cool. And yeah, doing user tests with games and kids must be amazing. Very fun.
It was, I would say, fun and the most chaotic tests that I've ever had in my entire life. Because at least with my brothers and my cousins, it was. Because, I mean, my cousins have the attention span of, like, a pea. You know, like, it's just, they just don't have it. So I was like, but why did you do that? And he was like, why did I do what? And I was like, why did you go here? And he was like, I don't know. And I was like, please say something. Like, it's just, even if it's because of the color. And I was like, is it the color? Is it the ground? Is it the stores? Is it, like, the greenery? What is it? And they're like, eh. And they just, like, shrug their shoulders. And I'm like, oh, my God. Okay. So it is hard. It has a learning curve. You have to learn a lot about body language, especially with younger kids. For example, I had smaller kid, I think she was 5, that I tested with, which was like a sister of one of my cousin's friends. And she was playing the game and she was testing it. And she just dropped the mouse and she refused to continue playing. And I asked why, because it was a very weird reaction. And she said it was because that road of, like, stores, because it was like a shopping mall type of game. You had one of those part of the stores which was more into, like, emo and grunge fashion items. So they were black and gray and they were very dark. So she refused to go in there. And when I asked why, she was like, because I'm afraid of the dark, you know. So it is funny because I could tell, but in her body language, that she was getting a bit uncomfortable. But in my brain, as, like, I mean, I'm 23, I was like, why is she scared of going inside of a row of, like, because it was more or less like a mall that was outside, like, kind of like Freeport, you know, like, it's outside. So you had, like, the clear skies and everything, but the boxes, so, like, the shops were black. So, but I guess she was just scared of the dark either way, so she didn't want to go. It was one of the most entertaining inputs and tests that I had, I would say, because I really had to go around it and get that information and be like, okay, but why, you know? And I couldn't ask why because, like, she's 5. She's not going to know how to reply to that. But yeah, those situations were fun.
I imagine it must be very challenging, but there is one thing with kids that you have guaranteed, which is, like, they'll be very honest, right? So a lot of times, yes, in user interviews, you have that bias, or you have to fight the bias of, like, people trying to please you or trying not to hurt your feelings or blah, blah. They don't really care about that. And that's actually a great thing. There are other challenges, as you mentioned, some, but that one isn't there, at least, which makes it probably a very sincere opinion.
Yeah, no, completely. I had one of my brothers just tell me, I mean, we are on the podcast, so I'll put this as clean as I can, but that the game was trash, you know? And I was like, okay, but why? And he was like, I don't care. It's just, you know, and I'm like, okay, that's good input. Thanks.
It's very upfront. Like, they don't waste any time with things that they don't like. They'll tell you that they probably are not great at explaining why they don't like.
Yeah, because I don't think they think too deep into it. They just don't like it and that's it. And like as more grown-ups, like teenagers and adults, like you have a critical sense of thinking. And because, I mean, humans are known for judging. You know, we are the only race that judges each other. And I guess that comes with age because, like, kids normally are not judgmental. Or if they are judgmental, it's because they've learned it at home. But yeah, they're just very honest, and especially adding that the family part of it being one of my younger brothers, he was just being mean as well. But That's just another part. Most of the kids were fine. I mean, I feel like a lot of the boys were like, why are you interviewing me? You're a girl. Girls don't play games. And I was like, just play the game before I get upset.
Yeah, that's the right answer, I would say.
Yeah, I was like, this is, I cannot have, like, I had to remind myself, like, I'm 23. This is a 8-year-old. I cannot reply how I want to reply. So I'll just say, just play. And shut up. So yeah,
that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, the depth of detail that you must on a gaming user research, I was just now picturing, because, well, when we say computer games, my mind goes to RPGs. It's mostly what I've played. And on the example that you were giving, why did you went there, I was thinking that when I play, I always go right. I enter a dungeon, I enter a room, I don't care, I always go right, because it's a pattern I follow in every game. Just to make sure I don't miss anything, I always go right. But yeah, I mean, how would I explain that on a user interview? I have no idea why it became that pattern. So it must be really interesting to have a whole world that is a product in the end.
I have the answer for you with that. It's just because normally you have player patterns. And normally, we call that the direction pattern. So either it's normally this way. Players that are story focused, normally they always go in front, okay? And then players that are very invested in quests and searching, like looting everything, they always go either to the right or to the left, depending on your main hand. So the hand that you write with. So normally players that write, their dominant hand is the right one, they would go to the right and so forth with the left hand.
That makes very much sense, because I love story, but I want to enter the dialogues with all the information I can to unblock all the options it's possible. So I loot first and then trigger the quests and the dialogues to make sure I get everything. So yeah, that's really, really cool. Thank you.
Now, yeah, there's a lot of player patterns with that, with eyesight, which is normally what you want to induce. So, for example, if you want to scare a player, normally you're not going to have something coming from either of their sides, because that's more expected. You're going to have it coming from above them or below them. For example, that's how it works with jump scares. Normally, if you have a jump scare, you don't have it coming from right or the left of your screen. It's always up or down, or if you have to like turn back and then there's someone at your back, and like an Outlast. Like Outlast has a crazy amount of jump scares like that, and just a guy with a electrical saw like just coming after you.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of to go into in terms of player paths. Eyesight is always that as well. Like you can, for example, feel more empathy towards a character if the character is positioned more to the right of the screen, because you're forced to kind of, in terms of eyesight, you're forced to read what he's saying in the text box and then get to him in the screen at the end of what the box says, you know, in terms of like the way that you read, because normally, at least people that speak English, Portuguese, etc., these type of languages, we read from left to right. So normally, if you're doing that pattern, and if the player is saying something like, for example, in Baldur's Gate, you have a lot of options saying that you can spare someone. And normally, if you have that, you can, for example, see that you are made into looking at the player at the right of your screen. For example, one of the things that they changed, that they did in one, I believe, one of the first patches of Baldur's Gate, is like when you start the game and you're like at the beach, you have Asterion, like the blonde guy, and like he is known for people playing the game just to romance him because he's like the cute vampire-y character and whatnot. So they wanted you to kind of kill him because they felt like everyone was saving him and never going forward with the story without him. So if you see in the beginning of when the game was released, in the first gameplays, Asterion was at your right because they wanted you to save him. And now when you start the game, he grabs you from behind and he's at the left of your screen. So yeah.
Well, spoiler alert for Baldur's Gate.
Sorry, guys.
It's okay. I've played it a lot. Really cool. And yeah, I mean, wow, didn't expect to get an answer for an old life question, which is why do I always turn right on games?
Now you have it.
But now I have it. That's really cool. Well, thank you, Mar. Thank you, João. I think it was a really interesting conversation. And cool to everyone that's listening. Hope to hear you soon.
Bye-bye. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.